Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before we get to our interview, a big announcement and celebration. Today's podcast marks our 100th published interview. A few months back, when I started to chalk up my 90th interview and realized that the centennial mark was fast approaching, I thought about doing a special show, much like TV sitcoms do when they reach such a landmark. But then I recalled all those television shows of the 1970s that would resort to cheesy flashback episodes that highlighted memorable moments and how much I disliked that. I don't want to jump the shark like those shows. And so I decided that even though we are at one of those points where one is tempted to sit back and reflect, it would be best to just keep doing what we've been doing for the past 2 years, bringing you interesting scholars talking about fascinating topics. And we do have that for you today. Nonetheless, I still feel the need to pause and thank all the folks that got our podcast series this far. When the idea to do a podcast popped into my head some 2.5 years ago, I never thought that I would get as far as putting 100 hours of interviews on tape for the world to listen to. But thanks to the enthusiastic support of the good folks at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, here we are. And I do owe them a great deal of thanks for believing in this project where others at different institutions were perplexed as to why anybody would want to waste time doing this, especially since you don't get many bonus points for promotion in academia. Byron Johnson, though, saw the potential for this program and immediately put the wheels in motion to make this happen. And Rod Stark, who serves as co-director of Baylor's ISI and who has long been a major intellectual influence of mine, also supported this program wholeheartedly. A very big thanks to them. And all the great support staff at Baylor, including Francis Malone and Cameron Andrews, made this process go very smoothly. Great things are happening at Baylor, and not only with the ISR or their athletic program. It is becoming one of the nation's most premier institutions of higher education, and anybody listening would do well to attend or send their kids there. Of course, I must also give a big shout-out to our technical support staff at Internet Imagineering, headed up by Neil Luft, who brings our website to life and answers all my dumb questions about what buttons to push. Please pay them a visit, too. I feel that it is also very important to thank all the guests who have appeared on this show, particularly in the early days when nobody was listening in. After all, who would want to talk for an hour with some obscure professor in the northwest corner of the United States about their research and realize that only 5 or 6 people are listening to it? But many of my good friends and colleagues were more than willing to play along, and the results sit in our archives for all you to listen to, and our audience has grown substantially since those early days. There are definitely some crown jewels in there, so don't be afraid to dig deep into the archives. Admittedly, I have been the biggest beneficiary of this project because I have learned so much talking to all these folks, and it has been a true blessing being able to play radio host for week in and week out. I'm hoping that our growing audience has benefited from the knowledge of these scholars too, and I know that it has reached many folks because I've heard that this show is being used in classrooms around the world, and that is pretty cool. Over the next 10 days, after today's interview airs, I am going to post my most favorite interviews and brief thoughts about them on our Facebook page, which you can access on our website's main page, www.researchonreligion.org, or search under Research on Religion with Anthony Gill over at Facebook. Ranking these programs will be no easy task, and I want to apologize to 90 of my guests for perhaps not including their interviews. I can honestly say that I've enjoyed every single interview I've ever done, but there are about a dozen or so that are particularly memorable, and not always for the same reason. You'll have to check in at Facebook to see what I'm talking about, and if you haven't done so already, become a friend of our Facebook page for weekly updates. And there is one more favor that I'd like to ask our audience. If you like what we are doing, and we do this as an entirely free educational service to the public, please tell your family, friends, colleagues, students, or members of your religious institution. There's now 100 hours of great information on a variety of topics, and there will be much more on the way. And that brings us to today's interview, so let's get down to it. Last week, we interviewed John Sweeney on a somewhat unknown pope who resided in the Holy See during the 13th century for a brief 15 weeks before willingly stepping down from that post. Today, we once again address the topic of the papacy, bringing it up to the present with a discussion of Pope Benedict XVI and his recent historic trip to Cuba. As you may know, Cuba has been a communist dictatorship since its 1959 revolution, and none too friendly towards those who practice religious faith. Severe restrictions were put on the Catholic Church over the past half century, yet it is an institution that still carries on and commands a great deal of respect among the general population. In 1998, with the Cuban economy in crisis, having lost much of its former Soviet support, Fidel Castro permitted then Pope John Paul II to visit. Just this past March, John Paul II's successor, Pope Benedict XVI, followed in his footsteps to become the second pope in history to visit that island nation. To reflect upon that visit and the state of religion in Cuba in general, I'm very pleased to have as a returning guest Professor Margarita Mooney, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she also serves as a faculty fellow at the Carolina Population Center, specializing in issues related to international migration, aging, religion, and education. She appeared on our show last summer speaking about her book, Faith Makes Us Live, Surviving and Thriving in the Haitian Diaspora. Since that time, she has become a founding contributor to the blog Black, White, and Gray, which can be found on Pathos.com. She shares blogging responsibilities with a number of other sociologists of religion, including folks like Brad Wright, who have also appeared on this podcast. And I visit that site quite frequently to get ideas for upcoming shows here on our podcast. We'll go ahead and link to Professor Mooney's book on our blog as well as her blog on our website. So please make sure to pay them a visit. Margarita, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony. It's my pleasure.
Hey, start us out with some background on religion in Cuba. What has been the religious landscape since the 1959 revolution?
Well, prior to the revolution, the largest religion in Cuba was Catholicism, but following the revolution, severe restrictions were placed both on the institutional church in terms of schools and hospitals were closed, most priests and religious were expelled from the country, and it became illegal to practice Christianity and also be a member of the Communist Party. So in practice, if you cannot be a member of the Communist Party, you're not allowed to attend the university, you're not allowed to work. So for the first 30 years of the revolution, it was practically impossible to practice Christianity, and on top of that, the institutional base of the church was decimated through the revolution.
Now, did all the priests just disappear? I mean, if nobody can get a university education or even get a job if they are seen going to Catholic Mass and, you know, maybe even get bad apartment assignments and stuff, why would anybody go to Mass and why would you need priests? What happened to the clergy and the hierarchy of the church there?
Well, two things happened. When the revolution occurred, nobody thought it would last 50 years, much less 10 years. So part of it was an attempt to save clergy from being killed. They were asked to leave, but expecting to return. So the clergy who lived in Cuba at the time of the revolution left. Keep in mind, a lot of clergy had been killed in the Spanish Revolution. A lot of clergy and religious were killed in the Mexican Revolution. So the institutional church, thinking it was protecting its people, asked them to leave. The problem was they could never go back. So within just a couple of years, the institutional church was completely decimated. Now, those priests or those studying for the priesthood who did remain, and of course there were some, they were taken to labor camps to be rehabilitated. And these labor camps included, you know, forced labor and, you know, high heat conditions. They were put together with other people thought to be ideologically opposed to the revolution or ideologically incapable of being integrated into the new revolutionary society. So forced labor was one way to try to reintegrate them. So even if those clergy had not fled, they would likely have suffered severe persecution. But those who remain were those who chose to stay and suffered the persecution and continued their work after they got out of labor camps.
Yeah, so I can imagine that this happens in the first decade or so after the revolution, and through the 1960s or so.
Right.
Do we see any thawing of relations between the Castro regime and the clergy, the Catholic Church in the 70s, much like happened with the USSR?
The first moment of reawakening was in the early 1980s. The first 20 years after the revolution can be described as a time of survival, but it was in the 1980s when the church tried to think and reflect on how they could reach out to the population and begin to re-Christianize and re-evangelize Cuba. So there was a five-year process of reflection with lay people, priests, religious, the bishops, which resulted in a pastoral plan that was published in 1986. And at that point, there was an entire generation of people who had been raised knowing nothing about Christianity, nothing at all. So the first step in the pastoral plan was to begin very slowly with catechesis and, teaching about the Ten Commandments or teaching what the Bible says, teaching about who Jesus is, very basic things.
And let me ask about that in terms of, people not knowing anything. Was there any, residual impact from the people who left? Grandma was a Catholic, and she told us stories when we went over to her house. So was it completely wiping the slate clean, or was there some residual Catholicism, maybe folk Catholicism, that was practiced in the population?
That's a great question. Most of the young people, that is people born, in the 70s or 60s, 70s or later, if they learned anything about Christianity, it was from their grandparents, because by that time, their grandparents were no longer in the labor force and no longer subject to the negative repercussions of discussing Christianity, whereas their parents, for survival, to work, to make money, would not talk about Christianity or their Christian faith in the home. They completely stopped practicing. So the only people who held on to anything were the elderly generation, and some of those people had their grandchildren baptized in secret. Some of them would tell stories in the back room of their house, or they would keep pictures of the Virgin Mary, or they kept a copy of the Bible. So you do hear these stories, but again, given all of the structural constraints on practicing the faith, very few young people were openly embracing or even searching. Now, by 1991 at the breakup of the Soviet Union, the loss of subsidies to Cuba, the economic crisis, and it's at that point where they actually changed the Cuban constitution to say that you were no longer prohibited from studying or working if you were a practicing Christian. And a year later, they changed the Cuban constitution to change it and say it's not an atheist state, but rather a secular state. Subtle, but both of those moves were very important. So it's in the 1990s when this younger generation begins to ask questions about who is Jesus, what is the nature of the truth, what should I be doing with my family? Very basic questions. And so many of the young people I met in Cuba had heard about Christianity from their grandparents, never learned anything formally. But on their own in the 1990s, when there was now this freedom to attend and keep their job or keep going to school, simply showed up at a parish. Again, we tend to think of social networks driving religious conversion or driving people to seek religion. Most people in Cuba are not going in groups. They're going as individuals, simply out of curiosity. What is this message? Who is this Jesus?
Let me ask you a little bit about how the institutional church revives during this period of time, because one of the things that the Catholic Church is a fairly centralized hierarchy where clergy are ordained by their bishops who get appointed all the way up the chain to the Vatican. And we'll be talking about relations with the Vatican here in a second. How were relations with the Cuban regime and the Vatican after the revolution and then moving into this thawing period of the 80s and 90s? At some point in time, and there is a cardinal that is in Havana today, how did this person get appointed? Where was the pool of potential individuals to, find a cardinal, find a bishop to appoint here?
Well, my understanding is that the hierarchy, the bishops, were never formally expelled from the country. They were severely limited in what they could do. They were intimidated, spied on, attempts to blackmail them. they were Cuban citizens. They couldn't be revoked of that right, at least. One other thing that they did to get rid of other priests and clergy was they revoked the citizenship of any foreign-born, naturalized Cubans. So priests who were born in Spain but had been in Cuba for 40 years could not stay. But they couldn't find a way to get rid of Cuban-born clergy and priests who never voluntarily left. So they did remain, and they, as far as I know, they never attempted to appoint their own bishops or cardinals. So they never, so unlike some stories you might hear about China, the communist government of Cuba never attempted to nominate their own leaders of the church. So what you had was a harassed hierarchy, but who was there and who was trying to survive. So then you also had the few who got appointed later to become bishops for some of those young clergy or even seminarians who had been in labor camps. Mm-hmm. So I attended, for example, the ordination of an auxiliary bishop of Havana who was in the seminaries in the 1960s and was in forced labor camps. And he's never left Cuba, and he stayed there, and now he's a bishop. So the relations, of course, were extremely strained because, as you heard with Pope Benedict's visit as well as Pope John Paul's visit before, the church has been severely restricted from carrying out its very basic mission of evangelization, but also social programs. So the relationships have been extraordinarily strained, and it's always been a struggle to even ensure the existence of the clergy, but there has always been some.
Mm-hmm. It must be a very interesting experience to have to go through seminary during this period in the 1960s and 70s and, you know, work your way up the hierarchy to become a leader of a church when you really don't have that much connection with the Vatican or, you know, a great deal of support around you in many regards. You know, you've had the opportunity to compare, you know, the Cuban church. You visited there several times. We'll talk about in a second, but also with, you know, in Florida and the East Coast and places where you grew up. So do you sense that there's a different mentality between, say, clergy and bishops in the United States versus those in Cuba who haven't had that big support network?
Well, the clergy in Cuba, I will say, are some of the most heroic people I have ever met. I think we often take it for granted, those of us born and raised in countries with a lot of liberty, political liberty, religious liberty, economic liberty, we take it for granted. So the clergy, but also the lay people who are faithful to Catholicism, are the most heroic people I have ever met in my life. Mm-hmm. Because to be a practicing Christian in a society where everything contradicts your faith requires a lot of courage, a lot of coherence, and a lot of perseverance. So whereas I'm not saying that any clergy or lay Catholics in the United States don't have virtues, I'm saying that those who have managed to practice Christianity and share their faith and joy with other people in an oppressive society are heroic.
Yeah, I can imagine it's very much like the early church leaders that faced a lot of persecution and humiliation for doing mm-hmm. what they're doing.
But I will say that you don't hear Cuban clergy or Cuban lay people complaining that Catholics or clergy on the outside haven't supported them more. One thing I like about the practicing Catholics in Cuba is that they don't fall into a discourse of vengeance, because a lot of what the Cuban government tries to do is to divide families and to divide Cubans who have left from Cubans who have stayed through this politics of blame and vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Cubans I wrote about on my blog and the Cubans and the clergy I have met, they're forgiving people. They want to build bridges with the outside, absolutely. But they're not blaming, and they're not vengeful.
Now, you mentioned you had some blog postings on here, and you do have three on the Black, White, and Gray blog that you run with some of your colleagues. We'll link to those things so that people can read those. They're great blogs because they fill in a lot of personal details and give stories of individuals who are there who you've come to know. You also mentioned in your blog postings that you've had the opportunity, starting in 1994, to visit Cuba on and off, which is kind of surprising because people from the United States are not supposed to go to Cuba. So fill us in a little bit on your personal background and how you got to Cuba and how that affected how you view things.
Yes, I was raised in the United States, My mother is from Havana, Cuba. She left in her 20s in the year 1961. My father is American. I was raised with a very tight, loving Cuban family that was also very involved in the Catholic Church in Cuba prior to leaving and suffered a lot of political repression at the time of the revolution. Now, it was not possible to travel to Cuba because Cuba didn't allow people to visit. That's often forgotten. But Cuba didn't allow its people to emigrate, and it only allowed people from the former Soviet Union to visit. Cubans who left voluntarily, like my mother, according to the Cuban government at the time, gave up their Cuban citizenship and gave up their right to return. So she was prohibited from ever returning until the 1990s. Now, with the economic crisis in 1991, suddenly Cuba opened itself up to tourism. Travel for American citizens to Cuba, believe it or not, has never been illegal. It is restricted. You may not travel to Cuba for the purposes of tourism or business, but the U.S. has never prohibited travel to Cuba to visit family for religious activities or academic activities. Now, what makes the press is when there are limits, let's say, on family visits, religious visits, but it's never been illegal. So what makes the news is when the restrictions on family visits are more strict versus less strict.
I see.
So as somebody with family in Cuba, I have never had a problem traveling there because I'm going to visit family, and that's always been permitted.
Okay. So you went down there in 1994. That was your first visit.
Yes.
What did you see? What did you find there?
It was the most shocking thing I had ever seen. It was in the middle of what they call the special period. And by special, they mean absolute lack of everything. There was no light. There were no cars on the road. The shops were empty. Even the tourist shops really barely had food. The Cuban economy lost all of its subsidies from the Soviet Union. In the meantime, in the 40 years after the revolution up to that point, its productive capacities had fallen way behind many other countries. Nothing Cuba produced was competitive on an international market. So once it lost its subsidies and its market with the Soviet Union, the government was completely broke. People were desperate. There were prostitutes all over the hotels, the clubs, the streets. It was very open, very obvious. There were very few foreigners at that time. Keep in mind what I said about how Cuba didn't allow very many people to come. That was absolutely the worst. I visited some distant relatives, and just to give you an example, they hadn't had toothpaste in months. I gave them a roll of toilet paper. It was the only one they were going to have for 3 to 4 months. They were elderly women who lived on the 7th floor of an apartment building with a broken elevator. They could barely leave their home. So I continued to go back through these family visits, and in other family visits, I went with some of my family members and went to homes where family members of mine used to live. I stayed with a distant cousin who, her and her side of the family, never left Cuba after the revolution. I visited some of the rural parts. So my mother spent part of her life on a sugar mill in central Cuba and then part of her life in Havana. I was able to go to central Cuba where the devastation was even worse because of the distance from the cities and products, meaning food, basic goods. There was no fuel to transport things, so the countryside was really devastated. But I kept going back, and I kept finding ways to go back. During this time that I began to travel to Cuba, I was working for Oscar Arias, who was a former president of Costa Rica, and he also won a 1987 Nobel Peace Prize. And I knew a lot about development in Latin America and a lot about politics. I have traveled all through Central America, Mexico, Panama, Colombia. The poverty in Cuba was distinct in two ways. One, because of the absolute scarcity of goods. Often, the problem with poverty is that people don't have the money to buy the things that they need, but poverty under communism means no eye. There isn't any. So it doesn't matter how much money you bring into Cuba, there's nowhere to buy olive oil, let's say. And the list goes on. So as a Cuban American who wants to help people on the island, it's very frustrating because sending money may not even solve their problems. Porque no hay, because it's not there. And on top of that, unlike other places in Latin America, you also can't help people to help themselves. So I cannot help a family member in Cuba start her own business, build a garden in her backyard. Está prohibido. That's against the rules. So you're really limited in what you can do to help other people. And the freedom, I think, again, as I mentioned, after I left the Arias Foundation in 1998, I began to study in graduate school at Princeton University in sociology, and my main area of interest was development in Latin America. And it was then that Pope John Paul II visited Cuba. And I heard some of his speeches, and I read some of them, and I thought, I want to read what he has to say about development in Cuba and freedom. And he had some very interesting insights. And some of his insights were about how communism had eroded the dignity of the human person. Now, all material poverty, I think, goes against human dignity. But to add on top of that, the denial of political liberty and denial of religious liberty creates in people a tremendous sense of frustration and inability to express themselves or be creative. And in Cuba, you really have no freedom to make choices about anything. So when I started to read his insights about sort of the human damage caused by communism, I thought to myself, he's on to something. It's not only that communism didn't produce the material fruits it promised, because some people will argue that it has, and I don't think it's necessary to argue about the extent to which the Cuban Revolution helped people attain more health care or have better education, because I actually think that that argument is missing the point, because the point is the Cuban Revolution deprives people of their humanity and of their choices about how they would want to use, for example, the education that they have been given. To illustrate this point, I one time met the Nobel Prize-winning economist Amartya Sen, who has published a wonderful book called Development as Freedom. And he goes over theories of development and argues that development is not only income, it's not only GDP, it's people's real capacity to use material goods, to choose ends and pursue ends that they themselves have freely chosen. So I asked him, because a lot of people who study Latin America used to think, it's less common now, they used to think that the Cuban model of economic development could be a model for other places in Latin America. So I asked Professor Sen, do you think the Cuban model is a model other countries could follow? He looked at me straight in the eye and he said, no country where you're not allowed to read a newspaper is a model for anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, that's a really salient point. And this is something that, as you mentioned, John Paul II addresses, and also Pope Benedict XVI has addressed too in his recent trips there. So let's go ahead and talk about that. Let's talk about John Paul II's visit back in 1998. And you said that was, again, a very formative moment for you. You're starting out in graduate school, and you know, things are really changing in Cuba during this period of time. Tell us about that John Paul II trip. It was pretty amazing. I remember, you know, watching in the news at the time as well, and people were saying, wow, you know, here's the Pope coming to, you know, communist Cuba. How did this ever come about? How is it possible for John Paul II to get a visit to Cuba?
Well, how exactly it happened is probably never exactly going to be known, but the Cuban government at that time was opening up in small steps, opening up to the outside world, now having lost the Soviet Union. And also there were some internal changes. I think after the fall of the Soviet Union, members of the Communist Party of Cuba were really debating what route they should go. And there are members of the Communist Party in Cuba who wanted more reform, economic reform, political reform, religious freedom. And I've heard this from many high-ranking members of other left-wing parties in Latin America, that there are reformers in the Cuban government. They're not always in the leadership or the strongest voices. But there was some sense even within the party, hey, listen, we should open up to the world. We should rethink how we do things. Look at what happened in China by that time. China had opened up to free markets in many ways. And as I mentioned earlier, China also has a more mixed approach to religion, allowing some liberties but also controlling things. But still, there's more religious freedom in China than there is in Cuba. So others said, hey, look, if the central aspect of the revolution is our economic system, then maybe we don't need so much religious persecution.
Mm-hmm.
For their part, of course, the Vatican cares a lot about the plight of the church in Cuba, and John Paul himself, having lived under communism, understood that people in Cuba felt cut off and needed support from the outside. And so there must have been some high-level dialogue about arranging this visit. And his trip was described by many people as a reawakening. To those people who had begun to explore the faith, it was a tremendous strengthening of their faith to hear his words and see his witness. But it also brought a lot of people seeking. Many of the people you saw in the crowd listening to John Paul II, they went simply because it was the first time anybody was given a public platform in Cuba to say something other than official Communist Party doctrine. What you hear on the newspapers, on the TV, what you learn in school, it's the same thing over and over and over again. There is no alternative discussion of ideas about anything in Cuba. So to give this man, the Pope, John Paul II, a platform, people simply wanted to hear something different. And after that, more people did start attending Mass, and at that point, the Catholic Church in Cuba had another process of reflection, how to take advantage of this awakening, of this renewed interest, and developed a pastoral plan, which they've been following for much of the last decade or 13, 14 years since Pope John Paul II's visit, which is really focused on addressing the anthropological damage caused by communism.
Now, what does that mean, the anthropological damage? That sounds like a big academic anthropological term.
Well, what it is, and this is actually the term used by the bishops in Cuba, and what they mean by that, is that communism has really denied any kind of dignity or rights of the individual because everything becomes secondary to the goals of the revolution. And so man needs to understand who he is in front of the truth of his own being as a creature of God, created in the image and likeness of God. Now, Pope Benedict also said this during his trip. So to give you some practical examples, what does this mean? A lot of people who were coming to the church out of curiosity had a very hard time actually living the Christian faith because in their everyday life, to survive in communism, basically you need to cheat, lie, and steal because most food you eat is from the black market, so it's stolen food and you're buying it underground. To survive, a lot of people are taking things from their workplaces to try to sell. And then you can't let your family members know what you're doing because if they know what you're buying and selling on the black market, then they could get in trouble too.
Mm-hmm.
So relations between people are not honest or truthful.
That's a really interesting observation that you make. And we oftentimes don't think of that as one of the consequences of a communist or dictatorial situation because, you know, you just think, well, the government tells you what to do and that's that. But it really does destroy those relationships, the networks and the ideas of trust between individuals there.
I explained this to a colleague from China and he understood exactly what I meant.
Yeah.
Because, for example, Pope Benedict, this has not been mentioned in the press very many times, but in every speech he gave when he was in Cuba, he mentioned the importance of marriage. And by mentioning the importance of marriage, he's not pointing necessarily to the church's teachings on sexual morality, but on the inherent good of giving your life to somebody else and living in truth and in love and in harmony. And in a system where you have to be untruthful to survive, it's very hard to be truthful in a marriage.
Now, one of the things you actually did on your blog that I really liked, and I want to stop you at this point to fill in a little story here, was that you told stories of individuals, friends that you have picked up over the course of going back and forth between Cuba over the past decade or two. And you told the story of Laura, which really illustrates that point. Could you give us an insight on who Laura is, or I should say, that's not her real name, but, you know, Laura's situation.
So in total, I've made 7 trips to Cuba, and in my last 3 trips, I returned to the same place called Santiago de Cuba, which is in the western part of the island, and the same group of people. And it was there that I met a group of Catholics my age who were involved in the church, teaching catechism, but also kept their government jobs. And so I met with them, you know, on 3 different trips of about a week, and I asked, you know, lots of questions about their church involvement, how they attempt to live their faith in the world. So, for example, Laura, who I wrote about in my blog, she's an accountant for a government office. And as such, she's constantly under pressure from her boss to, you know, change the books so that money can be stolen. And she won't do this, even though it's in her own self-interest, because she could steal money too, and she's being pressured by her boss, she refuses to do it. So she tries to live out, even in little things like that, living out your faith on a daily basis is a challenge. And so when Pope Benedict was going to Cuba, I emailed the people I know, because they had been emailing me for the past few months telling me how excited they were that he was coming and how they were looking forward to his visit. And Laura wrote to me after his visit, and she wrote a beautiful email, which I put, you know, word for word up on my blog. And I did that on purpose because communication with Cuba is extraordinarily difficult. Again, I think people might try to equate Cuba with other authoritarian regimes we hear of in the news, such as countries in the Middle East where there have been revolutions recently or where there's protests going on right now. But more than authoritarian, Cuba is totalitarian, and they control even communication. So, for example, it's very internet connection is dial-up. So it's the kind of connection we had 20 years ago. You can send very little information that way. Very few people have cell phones. Very few people have computers. All of these things are prohibido, prohibited. Now, they're starting to loosen up little by little. So when I first started traveling to Cuba, it was next to impossible to stay in touch with anybody once you left. Letters are censored. I've had letters, most letters I send don't arrive. Some do. Some letters I've gotten have been opened before they reached here. So I wanted to share Laura's voice with the world because to hear the experience of, you know, a young black Cuban woman who found the church on her own, has been faithful to Catholicism for the last 15 years, has kept her government job, and what struck me about her was how everything Pope Benedict was saying really had taken root in her beautiful soul. So, for example, she said, "I know that God loves me in a very special way, but I also know that doesn't make me better than anybody else. It's my job to love everybody and serve everybody, whether they're a believer or not a believer." Now, again, keep in mind, she's saying this in a context where the government is constantly trying to create conflict amongst groups of people, with Cubans in the U.S. who are called gusanos, worms. They're constantly labeling and denigrating different groups of people. So her desire to serve everybody is very beautiful. And also she expresses her ability to forgive. She's been persecuted. She's been accused of being a prostitute for no other crime than walking down the street and being beautiful. But you have no recourse to the law. There's no evidence that needs to be presented. She's simply been accused. And if she's accused 3 times, she could go to jail for it without any evidence. But she's forgiving. And so it's one thing to be a forgiving person in our context, but it's another thing to really be a model of forgiveness in a society that, quite frankly, is full of vengeance, because part of the way the system controls people is getting people to snitch, to tell on their relatives or on their coworkers. So you can get a promotion or extra money at work if you snitch on the person who stole. You can, you know, I have a friend, he's now a deacon in Miami, a deacon of the Catholic Church. He was in college, he attended church, as did his friend. This was in the 1970s, and they held a trial to expel his friend from college because he attended church. And this man refused to participate in the trial. And for refusing to participate in the public repudiation of a churchgoer, he was expelled. So it's this And then people become very resentful for the person who snitched on them or for the person who sent me to jail.
Yeah, it destroys those social bonds very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll point people in the direction of your blog posting, and we'll link to it on our website, because the story that you write about Laura is very salient. And you use the term heroic earlier on before, and you know, her heroism is, you know, amazing in the context that you mentioned. And even just to be talking about her on your blog, I mean, you know, you change the name and everything, but you know, wow, a lot of these Catholics, they put themselves in the line of danger in just daily practicing their faith and things that we take for granted here in the United States. And then to have that whole attitude of forgiveness is incredible. I don't know if I could do that. It's just amazing. So,
you know, Tony, as a sociologist, all of these trips to Cuba taught me something. I think it taught me the importance of social institutions to teaching morality and virtue. I think here we tend to define morality and virtue as somehow an outgrowth of character or spiritual gifts. But we take for granted the extent to which the society we live in, on a very basic level, rewards good. This society rewards hard work. Are there inequalities and some injustices? Yes. But in general, our society is set up to reward hard work, honesty, and prudence. This is the opposite in Cuba. The system rewards lying, telling on people. It rewards doing evil. So when I see people for whom to behave in a virtuous way is contradictory to the system where they're in, and to be a faithful Catholic in Cuba is to make a commitment to every single day go against the grain of your culture. Now, I know we hear some Christians in the U.S. who might think this is what a Christian has to do in the U.S., but at a very basic level, in terms of freedom to worship, freedom to marry, freedom to speak your mind, freedom to observe your conscience, what your conscience is asking of you. In Cuba, to be a faithful Catholic is to go against the system every single day. And that, psychologically, is very hard. So that's why, although a lot of people were initially enthused by Pope John Paul II's visit, a lot of people approached the church and would attend for some time. But there's a tremendous amount of drop-off because it's too hard to live in the truth.
And one can imagine that. And the story of Laura, again, is just, you know, monumentally historic in that regard. You mentioned that she had written to you via email, and again, we'll link to that on our blog so people can visit it, about Pope Benedict the 16th visit. So let's go ahead and talk about that, because you know, this happened just a month ago and, you know, got a lot of press attention. And as we mentioned too, that a lot of the press attention that came about during this trip was, you know, officially structured in ways that you would see this and not see that, and you bring to light, you know, through Laura and through some other people, what actually occurred here. But let's go ahead and lay the foundation for what's happening with Pope Benedict the 16th visit here. What was the reason for the trip? Was there a specific agenda for going specifically to Cuba, or was this just, hey, I need to make the rounds at all the Catholic nations, the next stop is Havana?
Well, clearly there was some priority given to visiting Cuba. The bishops in Cuba in recent years, since Fidel Castro became sick and officially resigned his position, though of course he still exercises a lot of authority, Raul Castro is making small steps towards, for example, economic freedom and towards political freedom. It was about a year ago, I can't remember the exact date, but through the negotiations of Catholic clergy and bishops in Cuba, they negotiated the first large-scale release of political prisoners ever since the revolution. I was stunned. I thought the Cuban government would not let that many political prisoners out of jail. But most, not all, but most political activists are also practicing Catholics, because after the revolution, the institutional basis of civil society in Cuba was completely destroyed, and the only institution that retained any kind of presence in civil society was the Catholic Church. So the Catholic Church clergy are the only group that really advocates publicly for the release of these political prisoners. Everybody else is way too afraid to speak up, because they'll end up in jail too. So this was quite momentous, to release these prisoners on the condition that they leave the country and migrate to Spain or somewhere else. But I think Pope Benedict's trip coming was to give hope to the church in Cuba. They've also been allowed to reopen, not just to reopen, but to build a new seminary. They have, for now, and the first time in 50 years, been allowed to contribute through their work, their corporal works of charity, through small programs in education, for example, or taking care of the elderly. All of this used to be prohibited. So I think Pope Benedict going there was both to express his solidarity with the struggles and the suffering of the Cuban people, and also to call for a greater opening.
You mentioned the charitable aspect of this, of what's going on, and that I, when I read your post, I was going, oh, of course, the Cuban government is, you know, going through very hard economic times, as they have been for many decades now, and you know, somehow it's dawned upon Raul or other members of the regime that, hey, there's this other institution here that, you know, historically has done really good with charity, taking care of people, of orphans, the sick and the widowed, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't we lean on them more? So is economic reasons driving the regime to say, hey, we maybe need to partner with the Catholic Church a little bit more?
Well, frankly, Tony, the economic need has been there in a desperate way since 1991, and it's taken them 20 years to make these moves. But I think it is a more overt recognition of the contributions to society that the church can make. I think the first opening to religion in Cuba was really at the individual level. We'll allow people to worship without consequences. But the second step took them 20 years, and that's the second step of the associative work, the social work of the church, being allowed to restart. So I think also the church has a history of doing this. It's a force for organizing volunteers. I know lots of Cubans who are not practicing Catholics, but they will volunteer their time for a Catholic social program. They're not going to volunteer their time for the government because they can't stand the government. Most people in Cuba, believe it or not, despite what you might have heard, they can't stand their government. But many people who are not practicing Catholics are very happy to go teach computer skills to children or participate in a program for the elderly, in part just because, as I mentioned before, people want to participate in a space that's not being controlled by the government. So whether they're really active Catholics or not, people go to Catholic social activities because they're free.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's a great pastoral way of reaching people too, you know, people who might not be all that religious, but the church saying, hey, you know, we do a lot of good things here. We build a lot of social capital, so you should maybe check us out a little bit. But deeper in that regard, one question that I have is that, you know, Fidel Castro is getting very old and he's been very sick for a long time. In fact, you know, there's not a month that goes by when there isn't a rumor that he has died, and the media has to, you know, cart him out and take some pictures of him to show that he is still alive and kicking. And even his brother Raul has, you know, getting up there in age. And so one might suspect that Cuba is at a crossroads now, that when the Castro family passes from the scene, changes are going to occur. Do you think that in any way affected the decision of the Vatican to send Pope Benedict out there and maybe lay some foundation for what is to come in the next year, 2 years, 5 years?
Well, Tony, there's no doubt that the transition is underway. It is slow, mm-hmm. often painfully slow, but Cuba is undergoing a transition. And I think Pope Benedict's visit was very important to encouraging faithful Catholics to participate actively and to not hesitate to ask for more rights, to ask for more ability to participate in civil society. And the Pope's message really had those two fronts. I think what gets picked up a lot in the media is what he says about politics. So what he said about religious liberty, what he said about the church's obligation to participate in civil society. It's a fundamental part of the church's position in society to do acts of service. This is not, and again, in his speech, he emphasized this. He slowed down and he said, essential religious liberty requires not only freedom of conscience, but the right to publicly act upon your faith, such as through works of charity. But there was a second part. There was a message directed to my friends like Laura, who I wrote about. And that's a message of truth. You know, the truth shall set you free. And authentic liberty. What does it truly mean to be free? And love and compassion and forgiveness. So he's speaking to the people because this transition is coming. And one of my fears about Cuba is that given all of the repression and the vengeance of so many years, the transition and opening to freedom could actually lead potentially to quite a lot of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So how can Cuba move forward without falling into vengeful conflict? But also, as I wrote about in my blog, Pope Benedict was making the point that the transition in Cuba is not only about economic and political transition, but he said there is no authentic fatherland without virtue. And what he means by that is that there is no nation, there is no authentic nation without people being freely able to choose the good. And being freely able to choose the good requires knowing the truth. So I think his message to the people in Cuba was, don't be afraid to know who it is you really are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
As I also mentioned the point about marriage. He said it in every public speech he made. He said marriage. He talked about the importance of marriage. And when I discussed this with my Chinese friend, he took the words right out of my mouth. He said, well, in a communist society, marriage and family is the only place anybody learns to love and trust. It's the only space you have to love and trust. And you can't function in society if you don't know how to love or trust.
Yeah. It's a very good point that you're making, and I think one that we oftentimes forget about in terms of studying transitions from authoritarian regimes and what comes after, even us political scientists who make a living out of studying this, is that the relationships at the grassroots level can be so highly damaged that utter chaos and devastation just can come out from one of these transitions. It's just not making the transition from an authoritarian regime to democracy. You don't wave a wand and being everything is perfect. But, you know, the fact that you're mentioning that Pope Benedict XVI really recognizes this, that there has to be repair of the social fabric in order for Cuba to move forward, is, I think, a very critical aspect of what might be going on there. What other things did Pope Benedict talk about when he was there? You mentioned authentic liberty, marriage. Were there other themes that he talked about?
Well, I thought that his homily in Havana was both quintessentially Benedict in the sense that it reflects recurring themes of his thought, yet also subtly directed to the current context in Cuba. To give an example, the theme of faith and reason came out again and again and again. And Benedict's argument is, and he said it very clearly, that faith, that everybody has an innate desire to know the truth, and he emphasized innate. And to know the truth, we need to engage our reason. And so he said that faith without reason can lead to fanaticism or irrationality. And anyone who acts irrationally cannot be a disciple of Jesus. So he linked this to a larger issue that he has been talking about for many years, which is the state of relativism in many Western countries. And so his argument is that people who may be secular or they may be believers, but they deny that there is any such thing as truth, end up denying the fact that we have reason that could lead us to the truth. And it leads to irrationality and fanaticism, where the truth is imposed on people. And again, this rings true in Cuba because the government doesn't have reason to stand on for what it tells people to do. And because it cannot point to reason or truth behind their laws or their ways of doing things, it must impose its way of doing on people against their will. And so here what he's saying is that the yearning for truth, that the Christian faith promotes this yearning for truth, which must be sought using reason.
Yeah, it's a very potent message, and one would not necessarily think that would be a big theme in Cuba, but one can certainly see how that is the case. How has the Catholic Church in Cuba reacted to the Pope's visit and his words? I know there was a Wall Street Journal article about a month ago, I think, leading up to Benedict's visit there, where they talked about some tension between the Cardinal Jaime Ortega and a couple of the grassroots priests taking different agendas on how to move Cuba forward, whereas Cardinal Ortega was viewed as being somebody who took a much more cautious, conciliatory approach, and some of the local clergy being a little bit more renegade and wanting to confront directly on. And there was discussion in this article about how one of these priests was assigned to go to someplace off in a very remote area of Cuba. Has Benedict's visit increased these potential rifts within the Catholic Church? Has it healed them? How has the Catholic Church in Cuba reacted?
Well, with all of the lay people and political activists and bishops I have spoken to in Cuba, there are really two schools of thought about how to deal with the government. And this is what I think the Wall Street Journal article you mentioned was pointing to. Although that article spoke about individuals who represent some of these different approaches, this debate has been going on for a long time. And the debate is essentially how much to overtly resist and protest against government policies versus how to take advantage of those people in the government who are willing to listen and perhaps accommodate to some request if it's done oftentimes in secret and certainly privately, not publicly. So the debate is, do we bring about change through vocal protest and opposition, or do we bring about change by trying to work with people within the regime? So what I think Pope Benedict's visit, he was visiting with, you know, the Catholic bishops, but also with many lay people, and he did not visit with, as far as I know, with any political activists or, as they would say, members of civil society. So he did visit with government officials, Raul Castro, Fidel Castro. He did not visit with members of civil society who themselves are practicing Catholics.
Yeah, no, there was one group called the Ladies in White who protest in one of the main town squares. I wasn't sure if that was in Havana or Santiago or
Havana.
In Havana, where they, you know, are basically marching to keep reminding people that there are political prisoners there. And they asked for an audience with the Pope, and they were not granted that. Now, was that because the government didn't grant them? Was it because the Catholic hierarchy said, no, we better not get too much in the face of the regime? Or was it a little bit of both?
It's hard to know exactly. Of course, his time was extremely limited, so I think that it was probably a decision based on prudence in terms of priorities. Now, some people will criticize him because he did meet, for example, with Fidel Castro. There are many people I know that if they ever got the chance to meet with Fidel Castro, it would not be a pleasant encounter. I'll just put it that way. But what I said in my blog is I think that by meeting with him, he's not signaling any agreement on ideas, but he's resounding a theme which he has always said, which is that people of all different backgrounds can agree to speak about important matters because we all have the possession of our reason. And so I think his reaching out was a sign that bridges can be crossed in Cuba. What I think in general with regard to Catholics in Cuba, there are many Catholics in Cuba I know who personally do not want to get involved in political activism because, as I've mentioned, if you become a political activist and you publicly state your opposition to the government, then you can lose your job, you can be sent to jail, they will harass your family. So most people I know who go to church in Cuba, they're not looking for politics. They're looking for a place to express their humanity, develop friendships, develop a spiritual life. Now, some of those people, and they can be lay people or they can be priests and bishops, on top of that, choose to become politically active. And those people, in doing so, undertake tremendous risks and should be admired as extraordinarily heroic. But I don't think the Cubans who are faithful to Catholicism who choose not to do politics should be criticized for it. From the outside, from our perspective, it seems like, gee, if all the bishops and all the clergy and all the lay people would just rise up, then there would be massive change. But I think for us on the outside, it's hard for us to imagine the consequences in people's lives for doing that. Yeah. And certainly, as a Cuban American, I've always wondered, you know, why don't people protest more? Why don't people stand up? And in one discussion I had with a high-ranking clergy member, who himself is known for his heroism and for standing up and speaking out against the government, his reply was simple, and it was, those of you over there, he pointed his finger at me, those of you over there have no idea how we live here every day. And by that, he meant that as a member of the institutional church, if he stepped the wrong way one day, they could crush everything that he has worked for the last 50 years. So the government in Cuba still possesses the power to totally crush the institution if they wanted. And so a lot of people are cautious about going too far because they're afraid of the repercussions. You could say that they're too calculating, they're too cowardly, or you could say that they're acting prudently and trying to make incremental change where they can without being totally decimated. Which strategy is the correct one? Truthfully, I don't know, but I do think I learned from my discussions with people in Cuba that it's very hard for those of us on the outside to know what is the right thing to do or expect anybody in Cuba to take a more confrontational path, given the consequences of that.
Yeah, that is a very good point, too, because we often, as political scientists who study religion and politics, which is what I do, we oftentimes want to see religious institutions getting directly involved in politics and mixing it up. It makes everything really nice for the papers that we write. But, you know, there's another aspect of this, too, that religious institutions are first and foremost religious institutions. And, you know, they have to think about the consequences of becoming too involved, as you just mentioned here. The regime could just sweep in and close everything down, and the 20 years of slow gains that have been achieved might just be erased in a day's time. But, you know, also that, you know, what the church does in the social arena oftentimes has immense impacts indirectly in the political realm as well. As you mentioned, just repairing these social relationships, either through marriage or just through building trust with other individuals within the community, will have immense impacts that we don't see directly through a march or a protest occurring. But nonetheless, it's very real and very important.
I agree.
Yeah. So give us, you know, in the time that we have remaining here, You've had the opportunity to visit Cuba since 1994, and you said you made 7 trips throughout the time. And so you've seen the changes. You've talked to people via email and direct contact when you're there. Give us a sense of where Cuba is heading, religiously, politically, or the combination thereof.
I will say I am more hopeful than I have ever been. These baby steps of religious freedom and economic freedom and freeing of political prisoners have given me a lot of hope. And I can hear that in the voices of my friends and relatives in Cuba. They have more access to means of communication. They have more freedom in choosing their work. And I can hear in their voices and in their comments a sense of hope for the future. So I am more hopeful than ever. But also, as you just said, I think that those of us who are not familiar with Cuba might very well underestimate not only the economic damage of communism, but as I said, the anthropological damage of communism. So although I am not able personally to bring about political change or economic change in Cuba, I do believe that through my friendships with friends and relatives in Cuba, through the exchange of ideas, through the sharing of friendships and love, that is building people up in a very human way to be able to take advantage of these changes. So, to tell you the truth, I've often hesitated to speak in public forums about my views about Cuba or even some of the things I have done in Cuba because I fear the repercussions of speaking publicly. I have friends and relatives who have traveled to Cuba and spoken when they've come back, and they're not allowed to return now by the Cuban government. But if I could close with one idea, I think that I have now decided to write more and speak more because this regime cannot last too much longer. It really cannot. And not just because the age of the leaders, that they're getting older, but the ideology is bankrupt. And the power of the ideas that the Pope spoke about, authentic liberty, essential religious freedom, building up society through marriage and virtue, those ideas are enduring because they correspond to the nature and the dignity of the human person. So the ideas that I have expressed today, the ideas the Pope went to share, Cuba is a totalitarian state still, but they cannot keep the truth out forever. There are changes coming. I think the government has recognized this. They're trying to manage it. They're trying to keep political control while they allow for economic liberty and religious liberty. But it's only a matter of time before all of that spills out, and there's going to be tremendous change in Cuba. It might take 5 more years or even 15 more years, but it's coming. And the people I know who live there now know this with more certainty than they ever have in their whole life.
Well, I think that is a very powerful way to close up this interview. And I will definitely make sure that we point our listeners to the writings and thoughts that you have been increasingly bringing to the public through your blog, Black, White, and Gray, as well as your other things. So I urge our listeners to check all of that stuff out, as well as Margarita Mooney's books, by coming to our website. And Margarita, I want to thank you for once again being on Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.